Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, here to help you build and rewire your fitness mindset. Today's episode, I am recording a little bit early because I am flying out to Vegas this week to run a 100-mile ultramarathon on Saturday. So I'm recording this on Monday, February the 10th, and it's going out Monday, February the 24th, so in 2 weeks' time, I think. And hopefully, all will have gone well, and I didn't die in the desert in Nevada, and hopefully I didn't break my body. So they're kind of like my two goals. Always when I do an ultramarathon, I'm like, well, one, I don't want to die, and two, I hopefully don't break my body completely, which I did after the Arctic. When I got back from the Arctic, I tore my Achilles and I was out for 3 months. So I'm hoping the future Brian isn't recording this or isn't listening back to this on the 24th of February. He's like, yeah, Brian, you fucked up your whole body. So let's keep the fingers crossed there. Also, I'm banking this episode because I'm staying in Vegas for a little bit of time on the back end of the ultramarathon. I'm bringing my mom and daughter over to Vegas with me, and I booked into a hotel that is like right beside this massive amusement park. And like, I'm so grateful. My daughter, she's nearly five. Holly's like a massive adrenaline junkie as well. So I'm like, yeah, she got that from me. I'm like, I'm so glad you're an adrenaline junkie. She's like, let's go on the high roller coaster. I'm like, yes, let's fucking do it. So I am pre-banking this episode because I won't be working for those days. So I'm doing this podcast on the back of some questions that came in through my Instagram. So over the last couple of weeks, there has been wide-ranging topics covered on my 10 question a day Instagram on Brian_Keane_fitness on Instagram. And I've taken some of those questions and I'm going to expand on them in today's podcast. So they're all over the place in terms of nutrition, mindset, life questions. So hopefully you enjoy. First question. Hey, Brian, are TDEE calculators accurate for measuring or tracking body fat? So a TDEE calculator is a total daily energy expenditure calculator, and they measure how many calories you burn per day. So normally the two units that people use, the two calculators people will use to determine how many calories they should eat, is either a TDEE calculator, as I've mentioned, or a BMR calculator, which is a basic metabolic rate calculator. And that just gives you the number of calories you need each day to survive effectively. So a TDEE tends to be a little bit better because it takes into account a little bit more than just a basic metabolic rate calculator. So without complicating this too much, because you can get into the weeds with things like TDEE calculators, BMR calculators, calculating your calories, calculating your macro split. The question or the answer on whether they are accurate is not dissimilar whether you're using whatever kind of calculator you're using, because at the end of the day, you have to figure out what number you're using for calorie intake or macro split, and then you need to test it. When it comes to a total daily energy expenditure, the advantage it gives you is that it takes into account a little bit more of your activity levels. So if you're fairly active, that will be taken into consideration versus a basic metabolic rate calculator, which won't be. So what normally happens when people do a BMR calculator is the number comes in very low, and then people eat at that number when it didn't take into account the fact that you're training for an hour a day or you're walking 10,000 steps or whatever it is. So there's a lot of trial and error that will come with that. But similar to a TDEE calculator, at the end of the day, you have to test the numbers to see how your body responds. As much as I'd love to say you can put your number, your height, your weight, your daily output, all of these things into any calculator online, and for a TDEE calculator or a BMR, a basic metabolic rate calculator, you can literally just Google those and it'll bring them up. But at the end of the day, you can write down numbers on a notepad and pen or put them into an online calculator online, and your body doesn't know what those numbers are, meaning that you have to test it to see what works. And one of the reasons that in, say, my BKF online program or any good reputable coach will do something similar is you will start with a number of a calorie intake. So let's say, for example, your maintenance calories is 2,000 calories. So you have to eat 2,000 calories to maintain the same weight, your maintenance calories. If you eat more than 2,000 calories, you'll put on weight. If you eat less than 2,000 calories, you'll lose weight. That's a super simplified term. It doesn't take anything else into consideration, but that's the basic model for calorie calculation in terms of going to a deficit or a surplus, to keep it super simple. So let's say, for example, somebody has 2,000 calories as their maintenance. What you want to do is you want to get into a deficit of weight loss or fat loss is their goal, and you want to go into a surplus if building muscle or adding size is their goal. So you always want to find the sweet spot for the individual. Ideally, when weight loss is the goal or fat loss is the goal, you want to do the minimum effective dose or maximum effective dose in this case, where you keep your calorie intake as high as possible, but you're still within that deficit. So in this scenario, that would be, say, 1900 calories, meaning that you would test 1900 calories, see how your body responds, and for the majority of people, that would be enough to help them lose body fat. But again, it comes down to the testing model. For some people, you might have to go a little bit lower. You'd have to go to 1800 calories. But what testing it does is it gives you feedback. And as I mentioned, it's great to have your numbers worked out on a calculator or have your numbers worked out in a notepad. But until you test them, you're not going to see what's going to work best for your body. There's lots of different factors that are going to determine how well you stick to a nutritional plan. Your calorie intake is just one of those. You know, the macro split is going to be another. You know, do you work better off carbohydrates, or do you work better off fats, or do you work better off a carbohydrate cycling program where you have a lower intake on rest days and a higher intake on intense training days? Do you work better with higher protein foods to keep you satiated? Do you work better with including some form of flexible dieting so that you have a 80% clean diet, but 20% of the time you eat what you want and you make up the rest of your calories with a chocolate bar? There's lots of other factors that have to come into play, but having a basic idea of your calorie intake is the starting point, especially if weight loss and fat loss is your goal. Ultra endurance athletes and athletes are a little bit different because there's other things to factor in. Carbohydrate and glycogen plays much more of a higher role, or fat adaption for endurance athletes. But when body composition is the primary goal for individuals, i.e. toning up, losing body fat, building muscle, etc., your calories are number one and your macros are number two. And are TDD calculators accurate? Yeah, they're semi-accurate in terms of giving you a number to start with and giving you a number to test. But you also have to test and apply that number. And then based on how your body is responding, adjust it. So you may need to increase your calories. You may need to decrease your calories. You may need to play around with your macro split, i.e. go higher fat or lower carb, or go higher carb, lower fat. You know, most people with body composition is the goal. Protein tends to stay pretty relatively moderate or to high. And then you play around with the other two macros, fat and carbohydrates, based on the individual. But again, you have to test these things to see does it work. So very similar to what the next question talks about on experience versus evidence-based, the reason I like TDE calculators, BMR calculators, is they give you a starting point. They give you a number to work from. And then once you have that number, you can literally test it to see how your body responds. And if you're designing your own nutritional strategy, you can do that. Like, you can 100% design your own nutritional strategy. Like, the only advantage a coach or a trainer or coming through a program has is that it does that work for you. But if you're interested in figuring out your own nutrition and you're interested in doing all the calculations and testing it, then I advise and implore people to do it themselves. Like, if that's something that you like and that's something that you're interested in and you want to build your knowledge on, I'm like, I would totally do it yourself. You know, you'll fall a couple of times and you'll take one step back for two steps forwards, but that's all part of the learning curve. Now, if you're on the other end of the spectrum where you're like, look, I don't give a fuck about TDE calculators. I don't care what my maintenance is. I don't care about any of that. I want it all done for me. And then I'm like, yeah, okay, go work with a coach, go work with a trainer, because that will cut your learning curve completely. You know, that's the way to do it. I do the same thing with areas of my business I don't care about. You know, I don't care how a video gets edited or even how a podcast gets edited. I don't care about the sound files. I don't care about the videos. I don't care about any of that. All I care about is that it has the quality of the end product of what it is that I'm looking to get done from that particular video or podcast. And some people are the exact same when it comes to fitness and nutrition. They're like, I don't care how my body responds to certain hypertrophy parameters. I don't care that I need to have this percentage of carbohydrate to maximize glycogen stores. Just tell me how many fucking bananas or sweet potatoes I need to eat. So find where you are on that spectrum. If you're really interested in it and you want to do it yourself, then I implore you to do it yourself. If not, then that's the time to go find a coach or a trainer or a program that will do it for you. So to come back to the question, are they accurate? Yeah, but at the end of the day, you still have to test it to see if it's going to work for you. Next question. Hey, Brian, are you more experience or evidence-based? I'm fascinated that you don't eat carbohydrates post-workout. Okay, so I'm going to break this down into a couple of parts. When it comes to my social media presence, for those of you who follow my Instagram or social media or are longtime listeners to the podcast, I tend to be very evidence-based when it comes to offering advice to other people. And the reason I do that is when, as a trainer or a coach or anybody that works with people individually or has an online social media presence, which is probably a better description, it's a lot easier to offer an evidence-based approach and a best practice for people because you're talking to a majority of people. And what the evidence-based approach means is that it's been scientifically studied for the most part to show that this thing works or what you're saying is backed by research so that you have somewhere you can send people or you have a reference point that could potentially help people better than, this is my opinion. And the reason that I use evidence-based approach is when I'm talking to the masses, when I'm talking to, you know, 80,000 people or 100,000 people on the podcast, it's very much a case of I'm talking about what will work for the majority of people because this is what the evidence suggests. However, when it comes to myself and my own personal philosophy, I use both. I will always use an evidence-based approach because I'm very analytical in terms of the way that my brain works anyway. It's one of the reasons that I lean towards the scientific side of things because that's just the way my brain works. When I'm trying to apply things for myself, in this example, not eating carbohydrates post-workout, I will use the evidence first, but I will test it and experiment with it based on how my body responds in my experience. And when it comes to this particular example, and this is literally how I do everything when it comes to anything with my own nutrition, my own training, my own business, my own life in general, I will use the evidence for the most part, but at the end of the day, it's always going to be about what fits best for me. So I don't eat carbohydrates post-workout. And even though for someone with a sports nutrition background and particularly working with glycolic-based athletes, so I do a lot of work with GA players in my GA Lean Body program. I do a lot of work and have done a lot of work with specific glycolic-based sports on the nutrition side. So rugby, soccer, hurling, football, etc. And glycogen stores and refueling glycogen stores is like the bread and butter basic of sports nutrition. So if you think of like a tank of gas in your car, you don't want your tank of gas to go to empty. And glycogen stores for an athlete are very similar. Like carbohydrates, which fuel your glycogen stores, you don't want that to go to empty as an athlete. You don't want to tap into fat and you don't really want to become fat adapted as a glycolic-based athlete. However, when it comes to, say, endurance-based athlete, there's an argument that being more fat adapted or falling into some form of mild or full-blown ketosis can be beneficial for long-term endurance athletes. And where I experimented with both was my coming into the world of ultra endurance, which is largely what I do now. So running ultra marathons, triathlon, doing things that are in the world of endurance. I do hypertrophy and I do my weight training because I love it, but I do my endurance events because they're the things that push me mentally, physically, emotionally, etc. And of all the net benefits that I get from pushing my body to that level and pushing my mind to that level because the shit fucking hurts. So the reason that I do that is the reason I apply a fat-based approach to that, meaning that I don't eat carbohydrates post-workout, is because I'm trying to make my body more fat-adapted, meaning that I don't hit the wall when I'm doing longer-based runs. So one of the things that I found, more so from talking to my other ultramarathon endurance athlete friends, was they get, well, I think it's called a boink or a bonk, where when you get depleted of glycogen stores and you're not metabolically flexible enough to utilize fat stores, meaning that if you don't keep topping up your glycogen stores with carbohydrates, either with gels or with food on your runs, you get this hit the wall feeling. And when you're a fat adapted athlete, which I am primarily, I'm quite metabolically flexible. I can utilize both through having done it for, you know, 12 to 18 months of trying to make myself metabolically flexible enough to utilize glucose and carbohydrate or glucose and glycogen from carbohydrate versus fat being from being a fat adapted fuel source, either body fat on my body or using things like chia seed gels or almond butter while I'm on longer runs, I don't get that hit the wall feeling. So one of the ways that I did that was I started training fasted in the morning. So I never train with food in my stomach. So I could do a full hypertrophy workout. I could do a full hour workout lifting weights or doing circuits. And then I could do a 20 or 30 kilometer run. And I will do all of that fasted. And one of the advantages that I have as being someone that's not really built like an ultramarathon runner, like I'm 5'8", 85 kilos, and I carry quite a lot of muscle for an endurance athlete. But one of the benefits of that is my body has fuel. My body can pull from fat stores. My body can pull from glycogen if I've eaten carbohydrates the day before, and I don't necessarily need to eat on my runs or in my training sessions to keep my body fueled. So having taken the knowledge from sports nutrition mixed with the world of endurance. So I have no specific qualification in the world of ultra endurance. It's just basically what you get on a qualification when you're learning to work with glycolic-based athletes. You're getting a little bit of fat adaption, but the research on that is relatively new. So I stay up to date with that in terms of how to apply it in my own life so that I can find what works best for my body on longer runs and what will support me best. And I don't use or eat carbohydrates post-workout because my goals and my personal preference, which I'll get into in a minute, doesn't actually lend to eating carbohydrates and replenishing glycogen stores. I just don't need to do it. Like when your body becomes fat adapted and when your body is used to utilizing either fat on your body or dietary fat that you're eating, you don't need the carbohydrates and you don't need to replenish post-workout. Now, am I saying that everybody here that listens to or that runs marathons or ultramarathons shouldn't eat carbohydrates post-workout? No, that's definitely not what I'm saying. What I am saying is finding what works best for you is always going to be key. And one of the reasons that I don't eat carbohydrates post-workout is one, I don't run that well off carbohydrates and never have. Like even when I used to compete as a bodybuilder and when I used to compete in fitness modeling, I never had to go that high with my carbohydrates because they just don't work that well for my body and they never have for as long as I can remember. I've always done better off higher fat diets. Like some people are just better with fats. Some people are better with carbohydrates by just genetic disposition or through a history of the way that they've been eating since childhood. And that literally is just what happened to me. I don't need the carbohydrates. So that in combination with not needing them for performance to replenish glycogen levels because I'm already fat adapted, mixed in with the personal preference of not really liking carbohydrates that much, where I like sweet potato, I like rice, you know, I like gluten-free pasta, I like all these things that I'll eat, but like I can go through my whole life without eating those foods, you know, with the exception of porridge and oats, which I do really enjoy. I can go through the rest of my life without eating carbohydrates. Now, if we're talking chocolate and ice cream, different fucking question completely. Like they're chocolate sugars, I'm all over that. But when it comes to the complex carbohydrates, the ones that normally fuel athletic performance, like I could take them or leave them, you know. Now take away my almond butter or take away my nut butters from me and I'm like fucking, I'm going to be clawing up the walls because I just prefer those foods and my body works better off those. So when it comes to an evidence-based approach, I'm using a little bit of the evidence to support what I do because of the fat adaption and the metabolic flexibility that can be very advantageous to endurance athletes. But at the end of the day, you have to experiment and find what works best for you. So when you're following my stuff online or I'm answering questions that aren't specific to me, this one is very specific to me, similar to what my next question is on my average day. They're very specific questions to me, so I can offer what I do in my experience. But when somebody asks, what should I do? Should I eat carbohydrates post-workout or should I skip carbohydrates post-workout? That is a whole set of different questions because it's about finding what works best for you. Do you need to eat carbohydrates to refuel after workouts? Does your body work better off carbohydrates? How do you feel? You know, are you okay with not eating them? Would you prefer to have them? All these are valid questions when it comes to setting up any sustainable nutritional plan for yourself. And that's goal irrelevant. It's irrelevant what your goal is. Like whether that's to run an ultra endurance event, whether that's to lose weight, whether that's to lose body fat, whether that's to build muscle. At the end of the day, when it comes to a nutritional plan, you just have to figure out, is the current nutritional plan you're eating in alignment with your goals? Is it something you can stick to? Does it include food that you enjoy? Once you hit those three things, you're going to be able to stick to most plans. The reason I don't have carbs post-workout, and just to give context, my post-workout meal is normally vegetables, salmon, and pink Himalayan salt. And again, not saying that that's optimal. That is a combination of, it works for me. I'm mostly plant-based. The pink Himalayan salt works for me because I sweat a lot during workouts. The salmon is a sort of source of protein and fat, and that's one of my favorite foods. So that's literally why I eat it post-workout. Is it the most scientifically optimal thing I could have for recovery? Probably not, but it works best for my lifestyle. Body composition isn't my goal. Performance is largely my goal and enjoying my food, particularly post-workout. And I spoke about in the last Q&A I recorded when people, I can't remember who sent in the question, when somebody asked about how to suffer through runs, because as someone that's very vocal on my podcast about my hatred for running, I tend to put something either side of that run that I enjoy that allows me to get through it. So normally I'll do my weight workout or circuit workout before my run because I love that style of training, and I'll have my favorite meal, which is vegetables, salmons, and pink Himalayan salt after, and normally some dark chocolate in there as well. And that gets me through the run. So I anchor something either side of that so that I can get through something like a run or a 10, 20, 30 kilometer run, because I don't enjoy any of that. And that helps me get through it. So I talked about that in the last Q&A. So maybe check and refer back to that one if that's something that stands out to you. So that is my thought philosophy on experience versus evidence-based approach and why I don't eat carbs post-workout. Next question. Brian, what is your average day like? Oh, interesting question. Okay, so I was briefly thinking about this one, and then I said I'm just going to like freestyle it, because I have a very different daily layout now to what it was several years ago. And something that I used to talk about at business seminars when I was running those business seminars once or twice a year was laying out your perfect day to hit and map to an end goal. And I'm a big believer in that, especially if you're self-employed or if you run your own business or if you're in some area of life that allows you control of your day. A lot of people who work 9 to 5, you only have control outside the 9 to 5. For the most part, you're set in a locked in location for a certain amount of time during the day. I'm in a very fortunate position where I don't have that anymore. So my average day looks very different now to what it used to look like. And I am significantly more productive now than I was several years ago, even though several years ago I felt like I was busier. And I've spoken on my business podcast, the Brian Keane Business Podcast, about, you know, being a busy fool and the difference between being productive and being busy. And being productive just means you're getting a lot of things done, and being busy means that you have a lot of things to do. They're two very different things. Similar to when I talk about losing body fat and losing weight, I'm like, they're two very different things. Losing weight is reducing numbers on a scale. Losing body fat is reducing the amount of fat on your body. And being productive and being busy are the kind of work equivalent of that. So my average day now, it varies. I give you a little bit of a brief layout on how it works through the week, because I am in a fortunate position that I am in full control of my day. I'm in a very lucky setup that I can only say yes to opportunities that I'm really looking forward to. I very much live off the philosophy that I will do things that I would do for free, and then I get paid for those things. And that's something that wasn't always a luxury that I had, especially in the beginning of my journey, where that just wasn't, I just didn't have enough. I didn't have enough clients. I didn't have enough of my business reputation built up. I just didn't have enough money. Where when you get to a point where you have that kind of FU money, where you can say fuck off to people if you don't want to do something, yeah, in the nicest way possible, like, here, buy this branded skinny tea. Like, you know what, fucking shit's really hit the fan the day that happens. Like, and you can fucking shoot me in the head if you see me. Here, buy the skinny tea. This will help you lose all the weight. But I'm in a position where I don't have to do any of those things because of just a lot of good choices that I've made. And again, I've made a lot of bad ones, and a lot of those good choices, as you, if you've read or listened to Rewire Your Mindset, my new book, like, a lot of those good choices came on the back of really bad decisions and just learning from them. You know, somebody asked me recently, have I ever made any mistakes? And I literally replied in DM, I'm like, my whole life has been a series of mistakes. I'm like, the only difference is I've learned from them, and I try not to make the same mistake more than once. And I think that's a good philosophy going forward. But when it comes to your average day, or my average day, the way that it looks now is I do most of my creative work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, meaning that I get up at 5 a.m. in the morning. I drive to the gym. I intentionally drive to a gym because it allows me to listen to a podcast in the morning. I normally listen to business podcasts, but again, it depends on whatever is the higher priority in my life right now. Generally, when I'm running ultramarathons or training for an ultramarathon, I listen to a lot more ultramarathon-based podcasts just because they get my mindset in the right place to set me up for the day. Then I go to the gym and I train for a couple of hours. When I leave the gym, I drive back an hour. That's always an audiobook. And again, the audiobook is always in relation to whatever is the higher priority in my life at that moment in time. And I've spoken on this podcast in the past about, like, turning your car into a a library on wheels. And the beauty of, say, driving an hour every day, or if you're on a commute, either public transport or driving, like if you're consuming audiobooks or podcasts that are potentially moving your life forward in a positive way, I'm like, that's going to compound positively over time. And I've got through countless, I've got 300 or 400 audiobooks in my Audible library since 2013, I think. 2014 was the first year that I discovered that Audible app, which is the Amazon app that you can use to download audiobooks. And so I listened to an audiobook coming out in the car. I then do all my creative work in the morning. So I'm recording this podcast at 11 a.m., which is a little bit later than I normally would record some creative work. But prior to this, I did my Instagram Q&A, which is responding and replying to questions that have been sent in on Instagram to try and provide value to the people following me on there. And it normally sets me up and gets me in a position to, say, answer questions on a podcast. So the reason I did that before the podcast today and recording this episode was that it just sets me up and gives me that a kind of catalyst for being in that mindset of responding to questions and elaborating and expanding on specific topics. So that's what that'll look like after this. I will be doing the rest of my tasks for the day. So going through Instagram DMs, replying to people on DM that message me on Instagram, setting up program work ahead of going to Vegas on Wednesday. On Tuesday, jumping ahead of the day. Then several hours into the day after I've done all my work tasks, I normally do a 2 or 3 hour window that is just completely downtime. So it's either a mixture of recovery on stretching, foam rolling. I've got different apparatuses that I use for muscle recovery. So I use a foam roller, a vibrating foam roller. I think it's called the Pulse Roll. I use a Muscle Mender, which is like a gun, a massage gun that's really, really good for your calves and traps. And then I have a stretching routine. So the ones from my programs, my BKF Online and my J.A. Lean Body Program, I literally use those hip flexor releasing stretches in there. And I'll do that for a couple of hours while sports or something on is on in the background on the TV. And in the evening, it's free. So family, bringing Holly to the playground, meeting my mum for coffee, meeting my friends for lunch, or meeting my friends for dinner, apologies, and then just completely chilling. And I'm normally in bed by 8 or 9 p.m. based on, depending on the day. And when I'm training for an ultra endurance event, I normally need more sleep, so I tend to go to bed a little bit earlier. Normally, I work really well off about 7.5 hours of sleep, but once my training volume goes up, where I'm training several hours a day, I need longer. I need about 9 hours to feel fully recovered between workouts each day. So that changes, and Monday to Thursday that more or less stays the same. Then Friday I take a half day, and Saturday and Sunday I don't do anything. I don't work Saturday or Sunday. They are family days, going to matches. I've got a season ticket for Galway, the football GAA, my daddy daughter day with Holly, meeting friends and family. And that's literally how my week works, unless I'm working an event or I'm running one of my own seminars, you know, such as the Rewire Your Mindset seminar in Cork on April 18th. That's Saturday. I'll be traveling down to Cork probably the night before, and I'll be running the event. And then on Sunday, I'll be coming back up and then going into the normal weekend routine. So that's kind of what it looks like. My eating then during those days is very plain. You know, I eat mostly plant-based, as I've spoken about in previous podcasts. A lot of nut butters. I've eaten a little bit more meat in preparation for this upcoming ultra marathon, just because I've kept my strength work and hypertrophy work quite consistent, more so in this 100-mile ultra marathon preparation than even the Arctic or Marathon de Sable. For when I was running through the Arctic and Marathon de Sable, they were self-sufficient in the sense that I had to carry all my food and equipment on my back. So I was trying to get my weight down and get my size down and reduce my muscle, because if I could get 2 kilos down in weight, it meant that I could carry another 2 kilos on my back of food, and that would support me on a multi-day event. Whereas for a 100-mile ultra, I'll have a small backpack with my food in the back, but it's actually not going to be that bad. It'll be nowhere near carrying 6 days or 7 days worth of food like I had to in the Arctic or the Sahara. So everything kind of maps into one another. But just to give you a very brief synopsis, I'm not sure how interesting or how boring that is, but that's basically what my day looks like from now, and has been pretty much accurate for the last 12 months or so. Next question. Brian, how long does it take to put on muscle if everything is on point? Okay, I'm not going to go into the specifics of building muscle here, because I've covered it in a lot more detail on previous podcasts. But what I will say is, you want to make sure that you have your expectation and reality very much aligned when muscle or increasing muscle is the primary goal. And the reason I say that is because things like fat loss and weight loss on the other end of the spectrum are quite quick processes in terms of you can get tremendous results in a 6 or 8 week period when fat loss or weight loss is the goal for someone, especially if that person has weight or body fat to lose. Because once you align the calorie intake with a good training program where they're moving more and they're, you know, you're increasing their basic metabolic rate by increasing their lean muscle tissue, you're doing resistance training to elevate metabolism, all these positive things, weight loss and fat loss can be quite a fast process. Whereas muscle building, on the other hand, is painfully slow, and the speed at which it responds largely comes down to aligning that expectation with realizing that for everybody, even people who are genetically inclined to put on muscle easily, it's still quite a slow process. And when I think of weight loss and fat loss, the generic thought I think is weight loss and fat loss, I'm like, yeah, 6 to 8 weeks, you'll get great results. When I think muscle building, I'm like, yeah, 6 to 8 months. You know, there, that expectation straight away sets you up to think about, right, this is how long it's going to take for good quality muscle gains to be consistently staying on my body. The problem with building muscle sometimes is when you build it, especially if you're quite lean and skinny to start with, and then you build it and then you get sick for a week, it feels like you lose it all. But that's where things like muscle memory come back in, and your body tends to kick back very fast and it comes back onto your body quite quickly. But people get disheartened and go, fuck it, I'm not even going to bother, which is never a good thing to do. It's about what you do consistently over time, which is going to determine how well you do in a body compositional goal, i.e. losing body fat, building muscle, etc. So as opposed to saying it's going to take 3, 4, 5, 6 months, I would just align your expectation and realize that it's a slow process, where fat loss and weight loss is quite a fast process in comparison, where you can get tremendous results in a shorter period of time. That just doesn't happen with muscle. But outside of that, assuming you're doing everything, you're tearing fibers down with resistance training, you're repairing back with eating enough protein and getting the amino acids to repair and recover, your overall nutrition is either in a surplus or at maintenance with that quality protein requirement being hit every day, and your whole lifestyle is in alignment with building muscle, and everything is on point, as you said, after that, it's going to be largely down to your genetics that's going to determine the speed at which you put on muscle. So people that are kind of in that mesomorph frame where they put on muscle quite easily, I tend to fall into this bracket. When I used to compete in bodybuilding, when I used to compete and travel as a fitness model, I always put on muscle and maintain muscle very easily. Even to this day, when I do ultra endurance events, I used to struggle with getting my body fat really low. Like, to get into those single digit body fats, I used to have to diet relentlessly in order to do that, because my body fat just didn't want to drop that low. But I put on muscle quite easily. So if I was put up against somebody else who isn't in that kind of mesomorph build, the chance is that I'm going to build more muscle over a 3 or 4 or 5 month period than somebody who isn't as genetically inclined to build muscle. So once you have everything on point, like you mentioned, the speed is going to be genetically determined. Some people will build muscle way faster. Some people will be way slower. And the process is exactly the same. Like, people that build it slowly or people that build it quickly, it's largely irrelevant in terms of what process you follow. Everybody has to do something very similar in order to build muscle. You know, as I mentioned, the hypertrophy parameters, for the most part, making sure your nutrition is dialed in and your lifestyle is on point, all those things need to be in consideration. But outside of that, then, to build muscle, it's just going to be a time game in terms of how quickly you respond. So how long does it take is kind of a how long is a piece of string question. But what I will say is, make sure you align your expectation on the front end so that you don't get frustrated after 4 weeks that you haven't built a load of muscle, because you're just not going to build a load of muscle in 4 weeks. It just doesn't happen. Whereas you could drop a lot of weight, or you could drop a lot of body fat in that equivalent 4 weeks if that was your goal. It just won't happen with muscle. But once you set that expectation up front and you're in it for the long haul, and you're enjoying the process of what you're doing, you will build muscle over time. Okay, next question. Brian, do you have any must-read book recommendations for personal growth? Okay, so I have mentioned on this podcast in the past, and I mention this quite regularly on my Instagram, that book recommendations are one of the hardest things that I find to give people, because depending on what stage you're at in your life or whatever is of a higher priority to you right now, certain books are going to connect way more with you. And one of the recent things that have came in is people asking me how I found this book or that book. You know, one that jumps to mind straight away is David Goggins' book, Can't Hurt Me, which is a great book, but one that found me way too late. And I'm a big fan of David Goggins. He's somebody that I'm looking to have on the podcast at some stage. And he wrote an incredible book on building, you know, building up your mindset and making sure that you are pushing through things that are really difficult and suffering and becoming stronger out the other side. And I remember reading that book going, this is a really good book. I'm like, but it found me 7 years too late. I'm like, I needed this book when I was 23. I needed this book when I was 24. I needed this book when I was 25. And that can happen with some people, that certain books will connect with you way more based on when you needed them, when you read them. You know, there's other books that are very popular books, The Chimp Paradox, Mark Mason's The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, two other books that jump to mind. I'm like, these are great books that I got nothing from because I didn't need those books when they came to me. I'm like, The Chimp Paradox, a fantastic book on not letting your monkey mind dictate how you make decisions. I had read so much on psychology in the lead up to that, a lot of Jungian psychology on making sure that you're not letting your shadow self determine what decisions you make. And reading The Chimp Paradox, I'm like, yeah, I didn't get anything from it. I had too much coming into that to get the message that who it was aimed for. So Not Giving a Fuck, another great book, didn't get anything from it myself, because I was at a stage in my life when I got that book where I'm like, yeah, I've dealt with, you know, I'd already written my first book, The Fitness Mindset, where I talked about the difference between opinions and facts and not letting people's opinions dictate how you feel. And that book's kind of an expansion on those ideas. So all great books, but I didn't get anything from them because they didn't get me at the right time. And I say the same thing about my books. So The Fitness Mindset or my new book, Rewire Your Mindset. Like, some people should read those books 100% and others shouldn't. I'm a big believer that if you connect with the message that's in those books and you look at The Fitness Mindset and you struggle with basic understanding on nutritional and fitness principles, and you're not clear on the psychology behind goal setting and having a why and the thing that are going to determine long-term success in fitness, dealing with your stress, anxiety, worry, I'm like, yeah, you should 100% read my first book, The Fitness Mindset. And the same with the second one, Rewire Your Mindset. I'm like, look, if you don't struggle with your mindset, if you've never had a problem with self-sabotage, if you've never had a problem with setting goals, if you've never felt like you've had your own biggest enemy living between your two ears, I'm like, you shouldn't read my book. I'm like, there's other books out there that probably help you better with whatever problem or issue you have in life right now. But for somebody who has suffered with that, who struggles to deal with failure and see it as a positive thing, who struggle with self-sabotage and don't realize that it's a feedback mechanism for improving, for people who struggle with setting goals and being clear and deserving and getting what you want and deserving what you want, I'm like, yeah, you should totally read my new book. I'm like, because it's got all of those things that you will need and those golden nuggets, hopefully, that you can apply that will help you hit any end goal. And that applies to absolutely every book across the board. And I'm going to give you some recommendations that I hesitantly will put my name to, that I got a lot from myself, and I'll explain some of them, why I got a lot from them. But also keep in mind that certain books aren't always going to connect with you for some reason. Sometimes it's because you're past the message in it. You've read other books, or you don't have that particular issue that the book is addressing, so you're not going to connect with the message in it. On the other times, sometimes it's too soon, where you'll read something and you just can't connect with it. One of the reasons I go back and reread my favorite books is because I will miss the messages at times because my life is in a certain point, and then I'll go back and read another chapter and go, fuck, I totally missed that the first time I read the book. And it's like you're reading another book. That's my philosophy towards rereading my favorite ones, because, you know, the analogy I used in the, I think it's the self-sabotage section of Rewire Your Mindset. I'm like, the Marcus Aurelius quote, that the same man never steps into the same river twice, you know, because new water has flowed into the river and new knowledge and experiences has flowed into the man or flowed into the person. And that's how reading books are. Like, when you reread your favorite books, you're in a different stage in your life right now, so you're going to connect with a different part of that. Podcasts are the same. Like, I normally save my favorite podcasts just on my phone, and then I'll go back and I'll re-listen to them because I'll connect with different parts of that message every time. And I advise people do something similar if they think it's something that will help them. But when it comes to book recommendations for personal growth, The ones I put in Rewire Your Mindset. So on page 203, I have it here in front of me, on the Rewire Self-Discipline, You're Not Born With It, You Build It chapter, one of my pillars for self-discipline is reading every day. And that is a combination of learning from the mistakes of other people mixed in with expanding my mind and keeping an open mind towards most ideas. And that's what reading will do. Like when you're reading contrasting points, particularly with, as someone that's in the fitness industry, when you're reading contrasting points on a carnivore diet versus a vegan diet, so one is super extreme, only meat eaters, only eats meat and that's it. Another is completely plant-based. And when I can read books or consume information on both sides, it lets me argue the opinions on both of those sides so that when I sit in the middle, I can entertain the thoughts. I love the Aristotle quote that the thought of the sign of an educated mind is the ability to entertain a thought without accepting it. And reading opens up your mind to new ideas. And what that can do is it allows you, from my experience, hopefully be a better interviewer when I have people on the podcast. But it's something that is a pillar of my self-discipline because I'm learning from the mistakes of other people as well. And it is shortening my learning curve in most things. But the ones I put in my book, in no particular order, Poor Charlie's Almanac by Charlie Munger, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari by Robin Sharma, a book that came to me at a very good time. It's one that I've reread a few times since, and it hasn't hit me as much the second and third time reading, but the first time I read it, it was very eye-opening to fast-forwarding on my life and realizing that if I had to press end right now, I wouldn't be happy if I was on my deathbed at everything I'd done up to this point. That book kind of opened my eyes for that. Letters from a Stoic from Seneca. Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, which is a book on the cognitive biases and an emotional versus rational thought. I will also say with this book, and hesitantly I put it into this list, is because it took me 3 attempts to actually enjoy this book. I had tried 2 attempts before, similar to what I said earlier about certain books coming to you and them being the wrong time. I tried to read this book twice and hated it. I'm like, this book is fucking shit. How is it an international bestseller? Not realizing that it was me that wasn't in the right place to accept the information in it. So I hesitantly put it into that list because I've got so much benefit from my own impulsive behavior and decision to make emotional decisions without thinking them all the way through. And that book has allowed me to see why I do that and kind of put a safety barrier in front of decision making so that I'm not being as impulsive when I'm actually deciding to do or not to do certain things. Mastery by Robert Greene, one of my favorite books of all time. Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, which is quite a difficult read. I normally advise people read The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday first, which is like an introduction to Stoic philosophy, and then Meditations is the obvious read after that. But it's written in old language. It's written by the former emperor of Rome, Marcus Aurelius, but it's something that I still refer to this day. It's one of my favorites. It's literally on my kitchen counter at all times, and I'll just flick through it on the days that I need it. And 12 Rules for Life by Jordan Peterson. So the newest book in that list, because that only came out in 2017. I have quite a soft spot for it because I was reading it in the lead up to Marathon de Sable, the 6 back-to-back marathons through the Sahara. And it really made me think that I'm choosing my suffering, and choosing my suffering is a good way to deal with my anxiety. It's a good way to deal with my mental health. It's a good way to deal with my compulsive overthinking that has put me into self-imposed prisons over the years. And that book made me realize I was doing that. And for the first time, it made me understand that I'm choosing my suffering. I'm running and I'm doing physical things that put me out of my comfort zone because it gives me a contrast point to when things are easier, and it just gets me out of my own head. And I have a soft spot for that book because of the realization that it gave me. And yeah, there's some of the ones that I have. Again, book recommendations are tricky, as I said, for so many reasons. So whether it's any of those books you read, whether it's my books you read, or any author, even the ones I mentioned at the beginning, Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins, The Chimp Paradox, The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, all great recommendations that I didn't get much from, but they're really good books if you need them. And if you look at books like Nuggets of Gold, and if you can get one nugget of gold from each book that you read, that adds up over time. And what I would advise people do, one of the best habits that I got into in recent years was anytime I see a book, either online or a recommendation in a podcast, or if I'm going through a bookstore that I think at some stage in my life I'm going to read this book, I normally buy it. And the reason I do that is because I'm aware that at certain points in my life, certain things jump out at me more. So I have probably as many books on my bookshelf that I haven't read as I have read, because I know at some stage I'm probably going to come to that book. And I like knowing that that information is there at hand's reach at all times if I need it. So that's something that I've started doing over the last couple of years. And it's something I'll continue to do going forward, because I like having those books there, because I never know when I need them. You know, there's certain days when I struggle with my mindset, and I'm just grateful that I've got all these books on Stoic philosophy there, and they help to keep me grounded in the moment. There's other times when I'm really struggling to get my training right for an ultra marathon or for an endurance event, and I'm glad that there's books there by Dean Karnazes, and there's books there by other ultra marathon runners, and books there on physiology that can just help get me grounded in that moment to be like, right, this is what I need to focus on now in order to get through this end event that I have, you know, in the coming weeks or coming months. So that's something that I've been doing, just as a side note, that might be a helpful tool for people to include in their arsenal, because it's something that's really benefited me over the years. Next question. Brian, motivation or even beginning a journey, where to begin? Okay, so I've covered a previous podcast. I can't remember the episode number. I think it was 187, maybe 189. It was the summer before last on motivation is horseshit. And that's largely how I feel about motivation. Now, just to expand on that, short-term motivation is a legit thing. Like, you can go on to a motivational clip on YouTube, you can put on your favorite song, you can listen to a podcast, you can listen to or hear or see something that gets you lifted and motivated. But that doesn't actually determine your results or what you're going to do over the long term. So when it comes to beginning a journey, what I generally advise people is just fucking start. Like, going from 0 to 1 is considerably harder than going from 1 to 10, meaning that getting started on any new journey, a fitness journey, a diet, a relationship, a job, a college degree, whatever it is, going from 0 to 1 is so much harder, because it's all about that difficulty in getting started. And one of my favorite quotes, it's from Robin Sharma, and I talked about his book earlier, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And one of his quotes that I really like is that change is really difficult in the beginning, really messy in the middle, and beautiful at the end. And that's how motivation is to begin in a journey. It's really difficult in the beginning. So whatever you have to do to get started, I would advise you do. And this is something I've changed my mind about in recent years, even though I still think motivation is horseshit. It doesn't determine what results you get. It only can get you started. But in the context of this question, sometimes understanding what gets you up and going or what gets you turned on is very important as a tool in order to get you going from the beginning. So one of the things that I used to look, I won't say look down on, but definitely one of the things I would have a mild frown about, was when people would join a gym and they'd go out and buy all the gear. They'd buy new shoes, new gym kit, and it's been 300 quid on gym equipment before they've ever done a workout. And that's something that I'm like, man, just get into the fucking gym. I'm like, just get in and do a routine until you figure out what you enjoy. But as I've got a little bit older, I realized that that's a motivational tool for some people. Having all the gear, provided that you actually do go to the gym, can be the thing that gets you excited about that first step. So it's actually something I've changed my mind about. Buying those trainers, buying that watch, signing up to a program, whatever it is, sometimes that's the thing that can get you from 0 to 1. And if that's what is doing it for you, then double down on that going forward. Just don't confuse short-term motivation with long-term progress, because they're two very different things. The thing that will get you from 0 to 1 isn't what will get you from 1 to 10, but understanding that getting started in the beginning is the hardest part. And whatever you need to do to get started, I recommend you do it. If it means that you sign up with a coach or a trainer or go on to a program, then that's what you do. If it means that you go out and buy that gym equipment or buy those new shoes or that sports watch, then that's what you do. Whatever you need to do to get started, just get that done. Get that first workout in, regardless of what that looks like. You know, build in the routine. You don't have to go to a gym. You can do home workouts. Sign up to a meal prep company if you don't want to prep your own meals. Do something that will get you started. And then after that, realize that to stay on the journey, it's about what you do every day, not about what you do when you're feeling motivated. You know, one of the things my mentors used to say to me, one of my favorite lines, is that successful people do the thing they have to do, whether they feel like it or not. And motivation is exactly like that. It's not about how you feel that's going to determine your results. It's not about eating well when you feel like eating well. It's not about going to the gym or doing your workouts when you feel like doing workouts. It's what you do consistently every day. And that includes the days you don't want to train. That includes the day you do feel motivated. That includes the day you do want to eat those foods. That includes the days you don't want to eat those foods that are on your plan. All of those things add up. It's about what you do consistently over time. So where to begin? Coming back to the Martin Luther, I think it's Martin Luther King, one of my favorite quotes, that you don't have to be able to see the whole flight of stairs to take the first step. Once you take the first step, once you get from zero to one, once you get moving, that's the hardest part. And then after that, it's just about what you do consistently every day. That's going to determine your results. Tell me what you do every day, and I'll tell you where you'll be in a year. Tell me how you eat every day. Tell me how you train every day, and I'll tell you how you'll look in a year. And adding that consistency and keeping focus on that consistency going forward, once you get started, once you get from zero to one, it gets significantly easier from that point forward, because then it just becomes about what you do every single day. Okay, last question. Brian, I really hate my job and want to go back to college but can't afford it. Any tips? Okay, it's nearly like three different parts to a question. Hating your job, going back to college, and not being able to afford something. So I'm going to kind of deconstruct that slightly. When it comes to going back to college, I spoke about this on a recent podcast. Well, it wasn't recent. It was actually about a year ago now, with Paul Germany on one of the first ever random shows we did. Paul threw me a curveball at the end of the episode about potentially going back to college himself. And just to kind of fast forward, spoiler alert, he now lives in Vietnam, just running his business online in Vietnam. So he went against the going back to college because of other primary goals that he had, partly due to that conversation, partly due to conversations with other people in his inner circle. But I would definitely recommend going back and listening to that if you are somebody listening to this and you were considering going back to college or university, because there are lots of different ways into different avenues of jobs that don't require you to go back to college. And one of my issues, and I'm not pro or anti-college, I have 2 degrees. My undergraduate was in business studies and my postgraduate was in primary school teaching. So I've been through the educational system, and I'm not pro or anti-educational system, but I'm pro college if what you need to do and the job you need, teacher, nurse, doctor, etc., requires you to have a college degree, then I'm all for college, university. I'm like, yeah, fuck, 100%, you should go back to college or go to college and put in the hours, put in the graft, get the degree and go and do the job you love. But there's a lot of jobs in 2020, and even more so as things start to shift over the coming years, that don't require a degree. And my only issue with people going back is the opportunity cost of the time, money, and energy spent on a degree that would be better utilized doing something else for a job that you don't really need a degree in. And so that's something that is worth considering. When it comes to hating your job, I'm a firm believer in that life is too short to be doing a job you hate. I've spoken on previous podcasts about my first teaching job, and I fucking hated my first teaching job. I remember having done 4 years degree, an undergraduate degree in business, and then another postgraduate 1 year full-time for my teaching, and then getting my first teaching job and being so happy and like, yes, I've made it. The last 5 years have paid off. This has been amazing. And then I got my first teaching job, and a month into it, I'm like, I fucking hate this. And you get what's called the sunk cost fallacy, which is something that you should never fall victim to. The sunk cost fallacy is where you've spent so much time, energy, or money on a specific thing, and you don't want to give up that job or give up that relationship you're in or give up whatever it is that you've spent time, energy, and money on because you've spent time, energy, and money on it. Like, it's the economic equivalent of throwing good money after bad. I see it all the time myself included, I'm lucky that I'm guarded against it now because I'm aware it's a thing, but I see it regularly with people. Relationships are really common where it's like, oh fuck it, I've been going out with this person for 2 years. I'm like, I'm not going to break up with them now. I'm like, it'd be 2 years wasted. Or I've done 3 years of a degree, I need to work, or 4 years of a degree, I need to work in this space because, you know, I spent the last 4 years studying in this degree, even though you fucking hate what you're doing. I'm like, that's the sunk cost fallacy. That's making decisions based on what you've done and not on what you're doing going forward. And being guarded against that thought process. One of the books I spoke earlier about, Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, has a chapter in there on the sunk cost fallacy. It's where I first came to terms with that philosophy of thinking and trying not to make decisions based on what I've done in the past and make decisions based on what's best for me in the present and the future right now, or best for me and my family or inner circle or whatever decision I'm trying to make. And I think your job falls into that bracket, that life is too short to do something you hate. And some people will be in a position where they can quit their job right now and economically or financially they're in a position where it's like, yeah, fuck it, I have enough savings, or I can move back in with a friend or a family member and I can go and do a job I love or go do something else that I love. And there's other people who aren't in that position where they've got a family, they've got a mortgage. But what I would implore people to do is, if you're in that position where you hate your job, I'm like, it's not about leaving it now or leaving it in the next 2 or 3 months. But if you're doing it and thinking you're going to be doing this for the next 10 or 15 years and it fucking fills you with dread every single day, like what used to happen to me when I was teaching, I'm like, start getting your ladder up against the right wall. I'm like, you don't have to leave it now. You don't have to even leave it in a year. But in 2, 3, 4 years, start getting your ladder up against the right wall so that you can make the jump. So when it comes to hating your job, going back to college, they're kind of two of my thought processes on it. There's something that I'm going to share that has really helped me when it comes to doing a job you hate. And there's two philosophies that I fall in between that I normally bring myself back to. And I'm in a very fortunate position now, as I spoke about earlier, that my life is set up on my terms for the most part now. I run my own business. I've got great people working for me. I've got a great family members in inner circle around me. I have full control of my day. I have FU money where I don't have to do jobs and do things I don't want to do. And I'm in that very fortunate position. I haven't always been in it, but I'm in it currently and I'm grateful for it. But there's a couple of thought processes that have helped lead me to this point. One was not living above my means. Two was the golden handcuffs theory. And three was a parable story that I heard when I was starting my journey first. And the not living above your means is something that I struggled with. And I speak a lot about it in the new book, Rewire Your Mindset, about trying to deal with some of my own insecurities by buying a new car, buying fancier clothes, buying an expensive watch, so that I would look successful and I would feel secure and people would think that I was doing well and that I wanted to look like I was doing well versus actually doing that well, because I felt so insecure in the way that I felt and the way that I was. And when I came to terms with that, and one of the things that running ultra endurance events gives me is that kind of self-discovery through who you really are when shit hits the fan. And that has helped me a lot more than all those purchases and all those things that I bought trying to mask an insecurity for who I was versus wanting people to think I was doing well or being successful just because I didn't feel like I was worthy of success or worthy of the right word, worthy of respect, for the lack of a better term, in other people's eyes. And when you pull it back, in my case, and realize that I was living above my means because I wanted to look successful, and it put golden handcuffs on me, meaning that I had to make decisions in my business and in my life because I needed to keep up appearances with what I was doing. One of the parables that I come back to regularly is it's one that really supports me in my thinking, and that's of the monk and the minister. And the parable goes like this, that two close boyhood friends grew up and they go on their separate ways. One becomes a humble monk and the other a rich and powerful minister to the king. Years later, they meet, and as they catch up, the minister in his fine robes, you know, who's been eating the best foods and the best wine over the last few years, takes pity on the thin, shabby monk seeking the help. And he says, you know, if you could learn to cater to the king, you wouldn't have to live off rice and beans. To which the monk replies, if you could learn to live off rice and beans, you wouldn't have to cater to the king. And I always think back to this because one of the things that was said to me when I was starting off my journey, when I wrote in my first book, The Fitness Mindset, about getting your ladder up against the right wall, where I did that thought experiment on would I rather earn £100,000 a year as a teacher or £20,000 a year as a personal trainer working in a gym. And my response was I'd rather be in the gym. And it was the first time ever that I had distinguished between what I thought success meant and monetary reward for that success, that I had been so confused about that earning money and the more I earned, the happier I would be. And as someone that's in a very fortunate financial position with a large amount of financial freedom and decision making that I have when it comes to like monetary expenses, I have to think about that regularly because for so long, I equals success. Lots of money equals success. That was the story that replayed over and over in my head. And as someone that has a proclivity to spend money to mask external insecurities, i.e. the new car, fancy clothes, etc., when I was able to pull the curtain back on that, I realized that I need very little. And sometimes I feel like I live off rice and beans, and I don't. I'm in a very fortunate position. But whereas if everything got taken away from me, because I love my job so much and I love what I do, and everything I do, even though I get paid extremely well for it, I would do it for free. It's something I absolutely love doing. You know, the talking that I do, the seminars that I run, the books that I write, the programs that I'm coaching on, all of these things are things I love doing. I have an inner circle of people around me, something that I struggled with for a long period of time and a large period of my life as someone that would consistently look for the next thing and would always be seeking that external gratification of set the goal, hit the goal, set the goal, hit the goal, and not being present in the moment with the people closest to me. And once I got clear on that, it made decision-making a lot easier when it came to what job or what I should be doing. And the reason I tell that is because if you're staying in a job now that you hate because of the money, if there is a way for you to scale back your life or scale back some of the things that you're doing that are stopping you from making that switch, i.e. massive car payments, i.e. massive mortgage when you could potentially be paying less somewhere else, i.e. going on 3 holidays every year, i.e. spending a load of money on nice clothes, new cars, because it makes it feel like you at least it the effort you're putting in with a job you hate, you're getting some reward for it. If that's your thinking and that's the thing that's stopping you making the switch in your job, try and rewire your mindset around that. Because as someone that's been in that position and was fortunate enough to get out of that position of doing a job I hate and now is on the contrast of having something that I absolutely love, it's the best decision you'll ever make. When I speak about your ladder up against the right wall, I speak about this in both books, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, that you are so much better to be at the bottom of the ladder against the right wall than halfway or at the top of the ladder against the wrong wall. And your job is exactly the same. If there's something out there that you would love to do, even better, a job that you would potentially do for free where you can't believe you get paid to do it, I would try and get that ladder up against that wall. When it comes to not being able to afford it, then I would ask yourself the question that I mentioned at the beginning of the question. Do you really need to go back to college to get that job you want? Now, if you ask that question and it's a doctor or a teacher or a nurse, something you genuinely need a qualification for, yeah, then I would start putting money aside. I would sell all the extra stuff that you have in your life that you don't use and you don't need. If you need to downgrade your car, then you downgrade your car. If you need to downgrade your lifestyle, then you downgrade your lifestyle. Like, it's getting your ladder up against the right wall with the thing you want. Stop spending money on stupid external things when there's this thing over here that you'd love to do, i.e. go back to college to get a degree to do a job you'd love. Then start putting the focus there. And if it's an insecurity issue about what will everybody think, then you need to get to the root of that insecurity. That's a whole different question. But what I will say, if it's something that's important to you, find a way to get it done. If it's important to you, you should be setting up your entire life in a way that is conducive to you hitting that end goal and getting that thing you want. And if you hate your job ask yourself, is this something you could do for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years? If it's not, then it might be time to start getting your ladder up against the right wall somewhere else. If it's going back to college and that's the thing you need to do in order to get the job you love, then that's what you do. If there's an alternative route, look at the alternative routes. If you can't afford it, then that's just about making decisions on your finances. Even if you got to live on rice and beans, it means you're going to do the thing you want to do down the line. I remember when I left, I spoke about this in a recent podcast with Alistair Hart, when I moved back home in 2014 and moved in with my mum and dad. I was driving my sister's shitty little Toyota Yaris and I had no clients and no business. I left my teaching job. There was a lot of issues that came with that in terms of I didn't want my friends to see me. I didn't want other family members to see me with no job. You know, I'd done nothing, but I knew my ladder was up against the right wall. I knew I was working and I was starting to build up a business and personal training in a gym, and which has evolved into what I do now. And I knew it was what I was meant to be doing. So it made the jump easier. And once you get clear on that, you have to drown out the noise of the external world. You have to drown out the noise of opinions of other people, because that's all they are. And if you make that decision, if you have the courage to make that jump, it will be the best decision you ever make. As somebody that has made it, has done the jump, felt the fear and did it anyway, and is fortunate enough to be able to talk about it on the other side, I implore you to do that if that's the thing you want to do. So that's everything from today's podcast. That is the Q&A, pre-recorded Q&A ahead of a ultra marathon in Nevada. So hopefully, as I said at the beginning, the top of this episode, that I survived that and I didn't die. Because if you're listening to this, then I'm beyond the grave. That'd be really creepy. So let's hope that's not true. And let's hope I also didn't break anything. Because fuck it. If shit breaks, it breaks. It'll heal itself. That's the beauty of pain. Pain is temporary and goes away. So that's everything from today's episode. Hopefully you enjoyed. Catch you all real soon.